Good evening and welcome. This is the Christian Science Monitor for Thursday, December 18th, 2025. My name is Greg Riddell for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today's intro is by Krista Case Bryant, editor. To understand the Trump administration's new hardline stance in Latin America, most notably Venezuela, correspondent Whitney Ulick takes us to Miami, home to a key architect of that policy shift, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who is also serving as interim national security advisor, grew up in a Cuban-American community that had firsthand experience with communism. He understands what a communist regime is and the damage it can cause, says Miguel Cosio, chief operating officer of the American Museum of the Cuban Diaspora in Miami. We're witnessing a philosophical shift in foreign policy. Let's begin with news briefs. The Senate passed an annual defense bill, authorizing a record $901 billion in military spending. President Donald Trump has pledged to sign the legislation, which would expand the purchase of military equipment, fund the Golden Dome missile defense shield, and provide Ukraine $400 million for 2026, among other initiatives. It also presses Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth to provide Congress footage of recent boat strikes. Meanwhile, Germany approved a $60 billion military spending package as it seeks to rearm. President Trump gave a primetime address to the nation last night. He spent much of the 20 minutes criticizing the Biden administration on the economy and immigration and lauding his own achievements, saying his government has brought more positive change to Washington than any administration in American history. He also announced a warrior dividend of $1,776 for military service members to be funded by tariffs. A fundraiser for Ahmed al-Ahmed, the heroic bystander who wrested a gun from one of the attackers at Sydney's Bondi Beach last weekend, has brought in more than $1.6 million. As of this morning, some 43,000 people have contributed to thank him for his bravery, which likely saved many lives. The father of two daughters is recovering from multiple gunshots. You and all the other heroes on the day far outnumbered the hate-filled perpetrators of this atrocity, one contributor wrote. The federal government admitted fault in a January collision between an Army helicopter and an American Airlines plane that killed 67 people. The official response to a lawsuit filed by a victim's family acknowledged that an air traffic controller and helicopter pilot played a role in the crash. The Army has since updated faulty altitude measuring systems. The Senate passed a bill yesterday meant to prevent similar incidents by requiring all aircraft in congested airspace to use location transmitting technology. Finland's Prime Minister has apologized to China, Japan, and South Korea for offensive posts by members of parliament. The incident began when Miss Finland, now stripped of her crown, appeared in a friend's social media post pulling back her eyes, the caption comparing her to a Chinese person. When that drew backlash, some lawmakers posted similar images on their own profiles. In a statement to embassies, Prime Minister Petteri Orpo said, "The posts do not reflect Finland's values." A statue of Barbara Rose Johns replaced that of Confederate General Robert E. Lee to represent Virginia in the U.S. Capitol. The civil rights activist was age 16 when she led a walkout in 1951 to protest conditions at her Virginia high school for black students. The student's case eventually went to the Supreme Court, and helped end school segregation. During the ceremony, Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin and said Ms. Rose courageously stood up to the lie of separate but equal. And now on to the first story. Many in Cuban diaspora find anti-Castro soulmate in Marco Rubio. By Whitney Ulick, reporting from Miami. United States belligerence in South America is at a new high with the launch of military strikes and the seizure of an oil tanker off the coast of Venezuela, followed by President Trump's order Tuesday for a complete blockade of sanctioned oil tankers going to or from that country. The moves mark a distinct shift in regional foreign policy from the anti-interventionism of recent decades. But for one cohort in South Florida, this is just what they have been waiting for. Washington's new activism brandishes the U.S. presence and policies that Cuban Americans here have supported since fleeing their country following the arrival of Fidel Castro and his communist plans in 1959. To many, it stems from having one of their own, Cuban immigrant-raised Marco Rubio, at the helm of U.S. international affairs. "That's our boy," says Lorena Cabrera, walking her two small dogs through the Cuban Memorial Park in Little Havana on a recent afternoon. She is referring to Mr. Rubio, who is serving as both Secretary of State and Interim National Security Advisor, and who many see as the central force behind the Trump administration's hardline stance in Latin America this year. The Cold War ended 35 years ago, and U.S. foreign policy, no longer consumed by the communist threat, shifted to a focus on terrorism and drug trafficking. However, for many on the political right in Latin America, and within the Cuban diaspora in South Florida, the danger of communism never went away. Mr. Rubio's rise has given broader reach to the Cuban diaspora's worldview, shaped by a historic loss of freedom, community, property, and human rights in their homeland. The U.S.'s new philosophy on foreign affairs reflects the perspectives of most of us inside the Cuban-American community to end the regime in Venezuela, and, of course, the one in Cuba, says Miguel Casio, chief operating officer of the American Museum of the Cuban Diaspora in Miami. For Rubio, an anti-Castro dream. The click-clack and swirling sounds of dominoes being mixed together on a table before a fresh round of play fills Little Havana's Domino Park in early December. Despite posted rules that prohibit yelling and using malas palabras, or bad words, one quartet breaks both codes of conduct within moments of sitting down together, quickly dissolving into hugs and laughter. Faced with a life experience of pain, Cubans are a very joyous people, says Orlando Gutierrez Boronat, co-founder and spokesperson for the Cuban Democratic Directorate, which promotes democracy and human rights in Cuba. "There's sorrow in being lost and disconnected from Cuba, our land. But man will find a good time anywhere," says Mr. Gutierrez Boronat, whose family fled in 1971 when he was 5 years old. He describes the mindset of the Cuban diaspora in South Florida. "With all the caveats that come with a 2 million-strong population, as patriotic, focused on family unity, prioritizing individual autonomy and freedom, thinking independently, and cherishing democracy." In the 1950s, when the Castro brothers led a guerrilla campaign to overthrow dictator Fulgencio Batista, many in Cuba believed the struggle would return the island to democracy, but Fidel Castro and his supporters soon began carrying out indiscriminate arrests and executions, seizing private property and assets, and turning to the Soviet Union for financial aid. Mr. Rubio's parents left Cuba in 1956, and he was born in Miami in 1971. Like many youngsters raised in South Florida by Cuban-born parents, Mr. Rubio grew up hearing how communism had destroyed lives there, and how the United States was uniquely positioned to bring about freedom on the island. As a child, he dreamed of leading an army of Cuban exiles to overthrow the Castro regime, he wrote in an American Sun, a memoir published in 2012. Mr. Rubio rose up politically in South Florida, working for the first Cuban-American woman elected to the U.S. House of Representatives, and eventually winning election to the Florida House in 1999. His decision last January to put the Cuban regime back on the list of state sponsors of terrorism, and the seizure of a Cuba-bound oil tanker off the coast of Venezuela earlier this month, illustrate Mr. Rubio's espousal of the diaspora's worldview, locals say. He understands what a communist regime is and the damage it can cause, says Mr. Cossio. We're witnessing a philosophical shift in foreign policy. An iconic regime. The Cold War, which lasted from the late 1940s to early 1990s, led to an ideological tug of war in Latin America between U.S.-backed anti-communism efforts and Soviet-supported leftist movements. The U.S.-backed military coups in Guatemala and Chile and supported authoritarian military dictatorships that saw leftist citizens as the enemy. For the United States, a central threat was the prospect that communism could gain a foothold in its backyard, says William Leo Grande, a Cuba expert at American University in Washington. Apart from Cuba itself, pretty much all of what the U.S. saw as threats in the region went away with the end of the Cold War, he says, and so too did Washington's focus on the region. But in 1998, members of the Cuban diaspora watched keenly as a bombastic former paratrooper was elected president of Venezuela, promising a new economic system that would forge a path between capitalism and communism. President Hugo Chavez's victory ushered in what was dubbed the pink tide of leftist populist leaders across the region who promised an end to elitist politics. The political opposition in places like Venezuela, Brazil, Ecuador, Bolivia, and Argentina saw communism in these leftist victories. Most of these democratically elected leftists explicitly praised or had close ties with the Castro regime in Cuba. The regime in Cuba is iconic to the left, says Mr. Gutierrez-Boronat. The U.S. mostly stayed on the sidelines. Converging on Venezuela. Today, from Mexico to Chile, it is common for leftist political candidates to be labeled communists by their opponents. Electorally, it's very, very effective, says Dr. Leo Grande. What appears to be shifting, however, is Washington's readiness to adopt a similar outlook. President Donald Trump stepped into the fray of Honduras's November presidential election to call the frontrunner a borderline communist, and he referred to New York City Mayor-elect Zohran Mamdani as a 100% communist lunatic the same month. In Florida, the state government introduced a new curriculum to teach the risks and realities of communism in public schools. Anastasios Kamoutsas, the Florida Commissioner of Education, expects other school districts in the country to adopt something similar. What Mamdani is pushing is very similar to what Fidel Castro was pushing in communist Cuba. It's important that our students understand these policies and where they can end up, he says. Mr. Trump's new national security strategy places the U.S.'s geopolitical focus squarely on the Americas. It frames Latin America as the source of some of the United States' most serious problems: drug trafficking, immigration, Chinese investment, and calls on the region as a whole to work toward U.S. goals. In oil-rich Venezuela, all of these interests come together. And since September, the United States has stepped up its military pressure, blowing alleged drug-running boats out of the water and deploying the world's largest aircraft carrier in an effort to remove from power authoritarian leader Nicolas Maduro, Mr. Chavez's successor. Washington says it is engaged in armed conflict with drug cartels, but the legality of its strikes is in question. Why are people asking if it's legal? Bomb them, says Adela Diaz outside a coffee window on Little Havana's Calle Ocho earlier this month, referring to the 25 vessels the U.S. has sunk and the more than 90 people who have been killed in the Caribbean and the Pacific. Maduro is held up by the drug money, she says. Maduro is holding up Cuba. They all need to fall. Marco Rubio and Donald Trump have the right idea. The Cuban diaspora in Florida has grown and changed since the 1960s. The children and grandchildren of exiles are further removed from the upheaval that communism brought to the island, and new arrivals do not always see eye to eye with the old guard. But one thing everyone agrees on is that communism is not good, says Juanadi Rodriguez, who fled Cuba in 2013 and now runs a political podcast called 23 e Flagler. That collective disdain for communism can translate to, in Miami, everyone is a communist. It just depends on who you ask, jokes Mr. Rodriguez. In 2023, an online news site accused him of being a prop for the Cuban regime, Mr. Rodriguez recalls, for promoting a policy of engagement with Cuba as a strategy for regime change. The loudest voices in the Cuban community here prefer an isolationist approach. When it comes to communism, Marco Rubio uses the word frequently. South Florida Cubans use the word frequently, says Guillermo Grenier, a sociology professor at Florida International University. It carries an agenda of us versus them, which is typical of current U.S. politics, he says. Jose Hassan Nieves Cardenas, who was a journalist in Cuba before his exile to the United States in 2019, finds that the resistance to communism is so strong that it serves as a conversation stopper. Once you criticize certain mainstream ideas, you are a communist, and you are banned from debate, says Mr. Nieves, editor-in-chief of El Toque, an online independent news site serving audiences mostly in Cuba. That concerns him, especially in this political moment. Life experience with an extreme political movement, such as the Cuban regime, tends to push people to the opposite extreme, he says. He's not surprised that the diaspora is largely conservative and sees eye to eye with Mr. Rubio. What does surprise him, though, is that the Cubans fled a caudillo, or strongman, and now seem to defend similar behavior from the Trump administration. Debate inside the Cuban diaspora, says Mr. Nieves, is more important than ever. You're listening to the Christian Science Monitor on Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of reading from over 200 publications. Next story. After strike on American troops, what's next for the U.S. in Syria? By Anna Maureen Grobe, reporting from Boston, I guess. The United States military lost two Iowa National Guard soldiers and a civilian interpreter in Syria, and saw three more of its troops injured in a shooting last week by an Islamic State supporter there. The violence threw a spotlight on the U.S. military's mission in a country newly emerging from civil war. Syrian officials had reportedly warned their American counterparts that an ISIS attack on U.S. forces could be in the offing. Those officials said the warning went unheeded. Though recently flagged for possible ISIS sympathies, the shooter was a member of the Syrian security forces, now a U.S. ally. The U.S. has had soldiers on the ground in Syria for more than a decade now, with roughly 1,000 U.S. troops there today, according to the Pentagon. Last month, Syrian President Ahmed al-Sharaa, who had ties to al-Qaeda, and a $10 million bounty on his head 10 years ago, became the first Syrian head of state to visit the White House. The rebel forces he once led, which, though Islamist, routinely clashed with ISIS, overthrew Bashar al-Assad last December. After their November meeting, President Donald Trump called Mr. al-Sharaa a tough guy, I like him, and hailed a new era of cooperation. Since then, and in the wake of the shooting, there has been talk of expanding the U.S. mission in the country. What are U.S. troops doing in Syria? U.S. forces first launched operations in Syria with airstrikes in September 2014 as the Islamic State terrorist group was rapidly expanding. By the following year, U.S. Special Operations Forces were conducting raids on the ground there against ISIS leaders. With some fluctuations, American forces in the country generally increased until March 2019, when President Trump declared that the U.S. had liberated all ISIS-controlled territory, including 100% of the caliphate. But some U.S. forces stayed on, as officials explained then, to prevent the resurgence of ISIS. The 1,000 U.S. soldiers who remained there, solely to finish the job of defeating ISIS once and for all, preventing its resurgence, and protecting the American homeland from terrorist attacks, Tom Barrack, U.S. ambassador to Turkey and special envoy to Syria, wrote on social media this month. The Trump administration also cut the number of U.S. bases in the country from 8 to 3 earlier this year. The eventual goal, according to the Pentagon, is to bring that figure down to 1. That will leave what U.S. officials describe as a small but strategic U.S. outpost at Al-Tanf in the country's southeast near the border with Jordan and Iraq. This is designed to give the U.S. security reach that extends beyond the anti-ISIS campaign, the officials say, including the ability to monitor Iran and a jumping-off point for surveillance and rapid reaction forces. Will the U.S. military force posture change as a result of the fatal attack on American soldiers, and should it? There has been no talk lately from the Trump administration of reducing U.S. forces in Syria beyond the current 1,000-troop footprint. There were, however, reports last month, around the time of Mr. al-Sharaa's stateside visit, of an expanded U.S. presence at an airbase in Damascus to support a security agreement that the U.S. hopes to broker between Syria and Israel. Such cooperation could also help prevent an ISIS resurgence. But some defense analysts question why the U.S. continues to put U.S. forces in harm's way when the original foreign policy objective of the U.S. to defeat ISIS was declared to have been achieved 6 years ago. We have defeated ISIS in Syria, my only reason for being there during the Trump presidency, Mr. Trump tweeted in December 2018, 3 months before officially declaring victory. This is similar to the question that arose in January 2024 when 3 U.S. military reservists were killed by a drone launched by an Iranian-backed militia close to the Syrian border in what became known as the Tower 22 attack. If we didn't have troops in Syria, there wouldn't be any U.S. targets, says Rosemary Kalanick, director of the Middle East Program at Defense Priorities Think Tank. As it stands now, she adds, the current Syria mission lacks a clearly defined endpoint. Talking about preventing the resurgence of ISIS is a way of saying that ISIS doesn't exist. How do you know that you're done preventing the resurgence of ISIS? There's no criteria for us to judge when this mission is complete. There has been some movement, if not a groundswell, among lawmakers toward withdrawing U.S. forces. I'm heartbroken that we lost soldiers, Representative Thomas Massie, a Kentucky Republican, wrote on social media after the attack. Now is the time to ask, why are we in Syria? What more can the U.S. do to help prevent terrorism? And does it involve retaliation for the recent troop attack? As the new, relatively weak Syrian government works to get its footing, ISIS may be looking for ways to reassert itself, officials say. For this reason, some analysts see merit in the Trump administration keeping troops on the ground, particularly since the fall of the Assad regime last year. But others question whether it is too dangerous for troops to routinely leave their relatively secure bases, especially in violence-prone areas. The U.S. should do whatever it can to give Syria a fighting chance at stability, says Adam Weinstein, Deputy Director of the Middle East Program at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, Think Tank. But I don't think they should be doing these kinds of routine joint patrols and meetings that expose U.S. troops to harm. Admiral Brad Cooper, head of the U.S. Central Command, which runs Pentagon operations in the Middle East, has warned that one of the big risks in the country is the large population of detainees, some 9,000 former ISIS fighters, who are still in Syrian camps. The U.S. military lends intelligence support to thwart prison breaks, but Admiral Cooper has stressed the need to repatriate the ISIS fighters to their home countries. Humanitarian groups agree, citing alleged abuses, including torture and poor conditions in the detention system, run mainly by Kurdish authorities under U.S. influence. And there is near universal concern about the risk of radicalization in the camps, particularly those that house the 38,000 families of ISIS fighters, roughly 60% of whom are children. Of those, nearly one-third are under age 5. There is no doubt that ISIS still maintains significant influence in these sites, Admiral Cooper said. Let us all double our work to protect the vulnerable and deny ISIS the opportunity to re-emerge. To this end, the Pentagon in September announced that it was establishing a special joint cell tasked with coordinating the repatriation of ISIS fighters and their families. As for Mr. Trump's promised retaliation for the U.S. troop deaths, senior administration officials have said that a major U.S. bombing campaign is unlikely. Such a move could upend Mr. al-Sharaa's tenuous political standing. Syrian government officials have been quick to show that they are mounting an ostensibly muscular response to the recent violence, with nearly a dozen security personnel arrested and questioned about links to the attacker. A more likely response from the U.S. could be raids against high-value targets, much like the U.S. carried out against a senior ISIS leader in July, Mr. Weinstein says. Another possibility is drone strikes on some targets somewhere out in the desert that are maybe loosely connected to the attacker, Dr. Kalanick says. They call that retaliation and move on. But that too comes with risks. Every time you conduct an operation like that, you risk killing innocent civilians, and, she adds, it perpetuates the cycle that leads people to terrorism in the first place. Next story. Gaza families wait and wait for answers about missing loved ones. By Gada Abdul Fattah, special contributor. Reporting from Khan Yunis and Dair al-Balah, Gaza. In a hall at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, mothers and fathers sit in white and brown plastic chairs, their faces carved with worry. At the front of the room, a staff member from the hospital's forensic department, dressed in a black vest, stands beside a large screen. He swipes images one after another, pausing briefly after each one, scanning the room for a flicker of recognition. None comes. In the audience, all are silent as they study the screen. Each of them has a loved one who disappeared without explanation during the Israel-Hamas war. These images might be their only remaining paths to answers. Among those silently studying the screen is Rida Ash Shari and her daughter Mahasin. The women are regulars. The photos are of deceased Palestinians whose bodies have been returned by Israel. They were handed over by the Israeli military through the International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRC, to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. The Israeli army has provided little biographical information about the returned remains, leaving these families in limbo. Mrs. Ash Shari searches for anything that might belong to her youngest son, Hussam, a familiar jawline, the curve of a brow, a hint of the face she last saw on the morning he disappeared on June 23, 2025. She whispers prayers under her breath. She wants closure, no matter how painful. None of the images belong to Mr. Ash Shari. Relief and despair rush through his mother all at once. "I was happy to know he is not there," she said softly, "but I also want an answer. Is he alive, or is he dead?" Though a ceasefire reached in October means the bombing of Gaza has slowed, the search for the missing and the funerals are only just beginning. A search for answers. Thousands of Palestinians are unaccounted for in Gaza. These include people detained by Israeli soldiers, lost in the chaos of displacement, buried under destroyed buildings, or killed in the pandemonium at aid distribution sites, some by Israeli military fire. The search for answers comes as Hamas and Islamic Jihad return the remains of the last of the 28 Israeli and Thai hostages killed in Gaza to their grieving families in Israel as part of the fraught and fragile ceasefire. The confirmation in October of which hostages died in captivity brought devastating clarity for Israeli families which had held out hope for their loved ones were still alive. Yet this step toward resolution has been delayed for many Gazans who have not been able to confirm their loved ones' status. To date, there is no final or official number of missing and forcibly disappeared persons, but we're talking about thousands of cases based on the reports we receive daily, says Ghazi al-Majdalawi, coordinator of the Palestinian Center for the Missing and Forcibly Disappeared. He points out that Gaza lacks DNA testing capabilities, and Israeli authorities rarely inform families which Gazans are held in their jails. Families live in a state of constant and agonizing anticipation, searching and hoping to find their loved ones, Mr. Majdalawi says. Like Mrs. Ash Shari, many are afraid of what the truth will mean. In pursuit of food. On the June morning that Mrs. Ash Shari lost her son, he had woken unusually early, startling his then-pregnant wife, Afnan. By then, people were experiencing severe hunger as Israel blocked food and medical supplies into Gaza. The shelves in displaced people's shelters were bare. Children cried themselves hoarse from hunger. "We're having a baby," he told his wife. "Let me go. We need food. Otherwise, you and our coming child will starve." He was joined by five young men from their makeshift camp. Together, they headed toward Al-Shakosh, a food distribution point run by the now-defunct Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, an Israeli-backed American organization. Al-Shakosh was one of four such sites, which, because of disorder and the Israeli military's use of live fire, locals had come to fear, calling them death traps. That evening, the five men from the camp returned. Mr. Ash Shari did not. His friends told the family they last saw him inside the Al-Shakosh compound, not long before the gates opened, allowing aid seekers to rush towards cartons of food. Then he was gone. Mrs. Ash Shari and her daughter have made a regular pilgrimage to Al-Shakosh on foot, asking anyone they could find whether they had seen him. The family began an exhaustive search of every medical facility they could reach, Nasser Hospital, European Gaza Hospital, Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, field clinics, and the ICRC's medical station. At Nasser Hospital, Mrs. Ash Shari approached a nurse, her voice shaking. "Please, I'm looking for my son, Hussam Ash Shari." The nurse checked the intake logs for that day. "No one with that name has come," he said gently, promising to call her if anything changed. That call never came. She returned again and again, and this time Afnan gave birth to their first child, Mohammed. She wonders whether he will ever meet his father. Mr. Ash Shari's sister took her search online. To reach more people, she asked a local journalist to share Mr. Ash Shari's photo on social media. Unwelcome images. On one morning in early November, Nasser Hospital announced that it had received 15 bodies from Israel. As soon as the news spread, Mrs. Ash Shari and Mahassan rushed back to the hall. Next to them sat another woman, Ahlam Sultan, who had been searching for her husband Ashraf for 17 months. She joined the others, seated before a screen, displaying objects belonging to the dead, belts, trousers, bits of fabric, scraps of clothing, scorched and torn, anything that might have belonged to the people they loved. They stayed until 2 p.m., scanning, waiting, bracing themselves. A father keeping his family warm. When Mrs. Sultan returned to her tent in Al-Mawazi, on Gaza's coast, her children, ranging from 8 to 17 years old, were sitting outside, waiting for news about their father. Mr. Sultan had disappeared 2 days after the family fled Rafah on May 13, 2024, following Israel's order that civilians should evacuate the city ahead of an Israeli offensive. The Sultans sought refuge in a tent in Al-Mawasi, where the children slept on sand. Her husband could not bear watching them shiver from the cold. He returned to their abandoned home in Rafah to retrieve blankets and mattresses and made it back to their tent safely. When he said he was going to make the trip a second time, his wife begged him not to. He insisted, she said, he wanted to bring bedding for the children. He never returned. Her 5 children watched their mother navigate the labyrinth of hospitals, checkpoints, and whispered rumors. It feels like living between 2 worlds, she says, one where he is dead and one where he is alive, and I'm trapped in the middle. Disappeared on way to mosque. Sausan Fathi Mahdi has also been living in suspended time since the earliest days of the war, 2 days after the first strikes on Gaza City in October 2023, following the Hamas attack that drew Israel into the war. Her husband, Fathi Hamdi Mahdi, left their home in Kizan and Kizan an-Najjar at 1 p.m., riding his bicycle to the neighborhood mosque for afternoon prayer. It was a routine he had followed for years. He often lingered afterward, visiting friends, exchanging greetings, checking the market. So, when evening came and he still hadn't returned, Mrs. Mahdi tried to steady her breath, but something inside her tightened. Something felt wrong. That night, she went to her brother-in-law's house. They called his phone again and again. At first, it rang once, twice, 3 times. Then the ringing stopped. There had been no reported airstrikes in the area that day. No clashes, no explosions. Mr. Mahdi used to avoid confrontation of any kind. He disliked Hamas and kept far from anything that could bring trouble, according to his family. Nothing about his disappearance made sense, his wife says. She reported him missing to the ICRC. He was last seen wearing a navy blue checkered shirt and jeans. Meanwhile, their youngest daughter, Lamia, a student at the University College of Applied Sciences, became the family's lead investigator. Instead of attending lectures, she spends her days sending forms, filling out online missing person affidavits, calling prisoner committees, and reaching out to lawyers in the West Bank. One lawyer said he would update us in 3 weeks, she says. The weeks are still passing. She keeps going. I fill out every form I find, the date he disappeared, his clothes, his ID number, everything. If I see a link, I stop whatever I am doing and fill it out. But she can't bring herself to do more, not after what happened to her eldest son, Hamza. He had gone to inspect their neighborhood one day and never returned. She later found his body at Nasser Hospital. I don't have the heart for that again, she says quietly. One family reunited. Surprises came with each batch of Palestinian prisoners released by Israel as part of the Israel-Hamas ceasefire in October and November. Ahmed Abu Ishtwi, who is in his 20s, had been believed killed, and then he stepped off the bus in front of Nasser Hospital as part of the release on October 13th. His family cheered and embraced him. After he had gone missing, the ICRC sent Mr. Ishtui's father a form via WhatsApp instructing him to submit paperwork to designate Ahmed as officially missing. They told him to follow up in 3 months. Nearly a month later, news arrived. His son was alive, held in an Israeli prison. The quest continues. Mrs. Ash Shari rushes to the buses of prisoners, faces stream past one after another. She scans each bus, searching for her son. When released, detainees walk down from the fourth bus. She freezes. A young man has stepped down. He is exactly like Hussam, she whispers. She rushed forward. My son, she cries, embracing the young man. But as she looks closer at his face, her heart drops. It isn't Hussam. Rumors only compound the difficulty. One of the released detainees tells her he had seen another prisoner resembling Mr. Ashari, but no one could confirm whether it was him. The family search goes on. Some days, Mrs. Ashari uses artificial intelligence to generate photos of Mr. Ashari holding his infant son, whom he has never met, trying to picture a future that the war stole from them. She remembers the way he joked constantly, the way he tried to make her laugh, even on the worst days. He never let me stay sad, she says, even during the war. You're listening to the Christian Science Monitor on Sun Sounds of Arizona for the print disabled. Next story. Partners in Empathy. Indian nonprofit educates travel firms to combat elephant abuse. By Anne Pinto Rodriguez, reporting from Farah, India. Travel executive Sanjay Arora recalls a work trip to the historic Amer Fort in India's northwestern Rajasthan state, where he saw tourists riding an elephant. It was swaying under their weight, he says. Its eyes were tired. Although Mr. Arora left Rajasthan feeling sad for the gentle giant, he was not fully cognizant at the time of the issues surrounding the welfare of captive elephants. A few years later, in 2023, Mr. Arora co-founded QXP India Travel, a luxury tour business. He acknowledges that in the beginning, the company occasionally included elephant rides at Amer Fort in their guest itineraries. Some Indian travel firms promote such rides as a quintessential tourist experience. Then he learned about the Refuse to Ride campaign launched by Wildlife SOS, an animal welfare and conservation organization headquartered in New Delhi. The campaign's website describes the abuse that elephants endure during training and later in their lives as riding elephants. The more we understood the hidden suffering, Mr. Arora says, the clearer it became that we could not continue to support elephant riding. QXP, whose clients are predominantly from the United States, the United Kingdom, and Australia, has since removed elephant rides from all itineraries it offers. For us, it was not just about removing an unethical tourist attraction, Mr. Arora says, speaking to the monitor via Zoom. It was about replacing it with something more powerful, compassion. Their spirit is broken. The International Union for Conservation of Nature lists the Indian elephant subspecies, Elephas maximus indicus, as endangered in the wild. Yet, the country has an estimated 2,700 to 3,000 captive elephants. Practically every captive elephant we see was once a wild one, says Kartik Satyanarayan, the CEO and co-founder of Wildlife SOS. They can never be put back into the wild. Snatched from their herd at a young age, elephant calves are starved and beaten into submission. Their spirit is broken, so people can ride them, he says. No wild elephant will let a human get on its back. The animals are then used for begging or for providing rides to tourists. A mahout, or handler, controls elephants' movements using a sharp, pointed tool known as an ankush, resulting in tattered ears and other injuries. The animals also are often restrained by spiked metal chains that cause immense trauma to their legs. Captive elephants can experience a range of health issues caused by abuse and neglect. Since its first elephant rescue in 2009, Wildlife SOS has provided care for more than 300 captive elephants, either at its facilities or the animal's location. Currently, Wildlife SOS is rehabilitating and housing 37 rescued elephants. Most of the animals are at the Elephant Conservation and Care Center, the ECCC, and the State of the Art Elephant Hospital, both in the town of Farah, in northern Uttar Pradesh state, while 4 elephants are at a facility in northwestern Haryana state. The hospital is the first of its kind in India. This year, Wildlife SOS launched a mobile veterinary unit called Hathi Sewa in Hindi, which translates to In Service of Elephants. The vehicle, staffed by experienced veterinarians, has diagnostic tools, including X-ray and ultrasound machines. The nonprofit also has a hotline for reporting an elephant in distress. Ethical options. In addition to creating awareness through its Refuse to Ride campaign, Wildlife SOS works to educate tour operators like QXP. Mr. Arora acknowledges the nonprofit's critical role in shaping his company's understanding of the problematic issues around elephant rides. They offered us research-backed guidance, powerful rescue stories, and practical ethical alternatives, he says. When travelers ask about elephant rides, we use it as an opportunity to share the reality behind the experience. Wildlife SOS has also partnered with the Responsible Tourism Society of India, which has thousands of local tour operators under its umbrella. Once people understand the abuse, they change their mind very quickly, Mr. Satyanarayan says. The same revenue or more can be generated without subjecting elephants to abuse. While some tourists coming to India forego elephant rides in favor of jeep rides and walking tours, Mr. Satyanarayan urges travelers who nonetheless seek an interactive experience with elephants to do their due diligence and investigate. Does the facility ensure the welfare of the animals in its care, or is it just exploiting them? He asks. Any place where there is riding, painting of the elephant, touching and bathing of elephants by tourists is a big no-no. As part of Wildlife SOS's volunteer program, tourists can help care for rescued elephants in a meaningful yet hands-off manner. The ECCC is open to receiving both short-term volunteers for a few hours as well as longer-term ones in exchange for a donation to support the organization's work. Volunteers get to join elephants on their daily walk, help clean the enclosures while elephants are out walking, and assist with meal preparation. Lena Walia Thomas, a Mumbai-based finance professional, has volunteered with Wildlife SOS for more than a decade. She appreciates how detail-oriented her volunteer tasks have been, especially those relating to preparing the elephants' snacks. She washes the fruits thoroughly, chops them down to the right size, and weighs them to meet dietary requirements. Everyone should visit to see the care and compassion with which Wildlife SOS looks after these elephants, Mr. Ms. Walia Thomas says, and to understand how not to aid animal cruelty. Wildlife SOS also retrains the mahouts of the rescued elephants and employs them as caretakers at its centers. We provide decent wages, medical insurance, on-site meals, and other benefits, Mr. Satyanarayan says. We help them unlearn their bad training habits and relearn kind techniques that use positive reinforcement. The nonprofit's latest campaign focuses on eliminating the centuries-old practice of using elephants for begging. These elephants are forced to walk in the hot sun on scorching tar roads, often while in poor health. Mr. Satyanarayan estimates the country has 270 begging elephants. Our goal is to provide every begging elephant a life of safety, dignity, and good health, he says. And finally, The Monitor's View by The Monitor's editorial board. Germany's defense of European values. The country has moved to boost military commitments and is outspoken about holding Russia accountable for its aggression in Ukraine. This candor affirms a growing willingness to step out of history's shadow and shine the light of democracy. In Germany, a national culture of remembrance, conscious of never repeating the horrors of Nazi militarism, is confronting the imperative of rearmament to support a reassertion of Europe's core values. As Russia continues to wage war on Ukraine, Germans' cultural shift offers guideposts to effectively defending Europe's security, as well as its liberal democratic traditions. Earlier this month, the German parliament voted to add more than 70,000 new troops to its army by 2035. This week, it passed the largest defense appropriation to date at 50 billion euros, nearly $60 billion. At this writing, Chancellor Friedrich Merz is seeking to convince other European leaders to exercise a difficult option using frozen Russian financial assets as collateral for loans for Ukraine's beleaguered government. Each of these moves carries risks. Domestically, as a Monitor News article recently reported, there's little appetite for military service among young Germans. Regionally, using the Russian assets, most of which are held by the Belgium-based company Euroclear Group, could carry monetary and reputational costs. Russia has just filed a $230 billion lawsuit against Euroclear in Moscow, and internationally, Europe as a whole is confronting a fraying relationship with the United States. Merz well understands the Russian threat to Europe, risks to the transatlantic alliance from Washington, and the economic opportunities of becoming a European defense hub, noted an analyst with the Atlantic Council this summer, and most importantly, he's prepared to do something about it. Even as American envoys shuttle between Russian, Ukrainian, and European leaders, Mr. Merz has urged the U.S. president to focus on elements for a lasting peace, which would include holding Russia accountable for the damage and loss from the nearly four-year war. Germany's newfound confidence and recognition of its potential for positive impact is reassuring to Ukraine and European allies, but it is also encouraging to its own people, signaling a readiness to move out of the shadow of the past while still using its lessons to chart a future based on moral clarity and democratic values. That's it. You've been listening to the Christian Science Monitor for Thursday, December 18th, 2015. My name is Greg Riddell for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for listening. Good night.